Legoland Podcast with David Amoyal.
Benvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to all of you that don't speak Italian. Thank you so much for joining us for the new episode of the Calcio Land podcast. And man, do we have a special one set up for you today. After we do our initial analysis of what we saw over the weekend with our great friend Alex Goldberg, after we name our winners and losers from the Serie A weekend, we're going to get into a great interview with our dear friend Dre Cordero, his fourth appearance on the podcast. I think you'll really enjoy his takes on Serie A, psychology, all the stuff you expect from Dre when he comes on the pod. And we're going to close it with another special guest, our Oracle, live on the show. Thousand Names is going to come on to give us his predictions for the end of the season. So if you speak Italian, you'll be able to understand everything he says. If you don't speak Italian and you're studying it, I'm translating it, and you can pick up some words here or there. So that'll be the last segment of the podcast. But before we get to all that, we are joined by our great friend, producer, co-host Alex Goldberg, and we have a lot to talk about what we saw over the weekend in Serie A. So let's go in order, Alex. Let's start with Saturday. What was your takeaway from that Inter-Juve match?
Holy crap. That was ridiculous. That's one of those games where you have to watch it in order to appreciate what happened. You can't miss the game and then say, oh, well, Juve won, we knew they would win, and just move on. No. That's all about the specifics. Of course, Douglas Costa scoring first, and then Vecino getting the red card, which at the time was controversial, but then it seems like, David, once the picture of Mario Mandzukic's leg surfaced on the internet, even Inter fans and Napoli fans indirectly were like, okay, that's a red. Oh, God, looking at Mandzukic, the holes in his leg from that challenge, that's a justified red. I don't really want to get into referee decisions beyond that and if Juve should have had red cards themselves. But seriously, once Juve is up 1-0 and they're a man up, you kind of just think, oh, it's over. The tie is over. Juve will certainly get the 3 points here, and probably the Scudetto is in hand. And then all of a sudden, second half, Icardi scores, and you're like, oh, well, hold on. Inter's got a little fight here. And then a player that I really love, and I think a lot of Juventus fans love him and Italian national team fans love, Andrea Barzagli with one of the crappiest own goals, really. I mean, he really showed his age on that own goal. Just couldn't even move his feet to kick the ball anywhere except the net. So that was kind of sad to see for me. But all of a sudden, Inter take the lead, a man down. I mean, you can't make that stuff up. That's incredible. And now all of a sudden, it's looking, wow, I tweeted it. I'll be honest. I tweeted, wait a minute, did Juve's season change when Buffon got crazy mad at the ref in that Champions League game? Is that when Juve lost their spine? We both thought, David, after that, okay, well, Juve is going to sack up now and not lose another game in Serie A. Almost quite the opposite. It started to feel like that really broke the whole back of the whole team, no matter what competition they were in. And then Paulo Dybala, who's had a lot of pressure on him recently, has definitely hit a rut as of late, just performed awful in the first half of the Napoli game last week. He comes in, so you start to think, can he have a heroic moment? Can he be clutch? Cuadrado, who is definitely the man of the match in that game, forces an own goal, so it's 2-2. And then I just think the last goal, the winning goal for Juventus, was so symbolic because Paulo Dybala finally had another clutch moment, which he had a couple months ago, but that was starting to feel like it was ages ago, delivers a juicy, juicy ball to Gonzalo Higuain, who also needed a goal like that. Of course, he's got the tag of not being able to score in finals, really, but big matches, we could say. And he puts home the winning goal. Now it looks like the Scudetto winning goal, but I'm going to be careful about guaranteeing anything from here on out. Such drama. Of course, Allegri was telling Dybala and Higuain, stop celebrating, get back. We don't want what happened at Real Madrid to happen all over again. So it was crazy to watch if you're a neutral. I'm sure it was crazy to watch as an Inter fan and eventually disappointing. And as a Juventus fan, I bet you pulled out all your hair and tried to put it back in at the end of the game. That was something to see. I just think it was so symbolic that Dybala and Higuain delivered on the game-winning goal. So that was my takeaway, David. How about you?
Yeah, and you hit on a lot of things that I agree. So I'll address the referee part. I know a lot of people want to hear my take on that. So let's just begin by saying what a roller coaster the past 3 weekends have been in Serie A in general. 3 weekends ago, we had a Juve-Napoli in the standings going up and down, so close. It's the roller coaster. Of course, Koulibaly's goal having a huge impact on the race at the time. You mentioned Juve going into the final minutes of the match, losing, and they completely turned it around. Imagine the reaction in Napoli when just a few minutes before they look set for Juve to lose, of Higuain, of all people, with the game winner. I want to give a lot of credit to Inter. You mentioned it after that Douglas Costa goal and the red card. You thought it was over. I thought it was going to go into Pazza Inter mode and they were going to fall apart. They deserve a ton of credit for how they came back down to 10 men. But as far as the referee, look, I'm going to be very consistent. I had the same approach with the Real Madrid match against Juve. I'm not a conspiracy guy with referees. But I will say just the designation of Orsato and how he was the protagonist of that match really reminded me of how the NBA would famously send referee Joey Crawford to series they wanted to see extended. I'm not saying the fix was in the match, but they put a referee that they thought could really influence the outcome. For me, it's a real shame that one of the biggest names left from that match is Orsato. If you mention the referees' names multiple times, it's never a good thing, especially in Serie A. So much attention on the league. We know how Juve is perceived by some. So definitely that was really unfortunate, and the designation of Orsato was head-scratching. It really reminded me of a Joey Crawford. But a couple of other things. I also want to be consistent. You know, a lot of the Juve fans that defended Buffon to no end because of his reaction to Real Madrid, I think you got to let Inter fans vent. But it's always easy to get sanctimonious when it comes to referee decisions, unless it impacts you, then that changes everything. So, you know, I think Inter fans, I can totally understand why they are so angry after that. But I'm going to say the same thing that I said after that Real Madrid match for Juve. I'm a big believer that you can have conspiracies, you can blame others, but that ultimately won't improve you. I think Inter leaves that match has to feel really good about how they performed, but they also are some clear opportunities for improvement. I thought Spalletti's substitutions left a lot to be desired. There was a lot of talk on Santon coming in for Icardi, Borja Valero coming in for Rafinha. Like, Inter clearly needs better depth. That's a huge gap between Juve and them, is mainly because of depth. Maybe had Inter had better subs, we wouldn't be talking so much about the controversial decision on Pjanic not getting the second yellow. Now, look, I think that decision's pretty much indefensible, but I will say we saw how Inter reacted after Vecino left. We don't know for sure what the outcome would have been had Pjanic gone out. So I think Inter, as hard and harsh that may sound, that's exactly what I said after Real Madrid. I think they need to look at themselves at how to improve. Spalletti's decisions definitely left something to be desired. Handanovic, a player that we've praised a ton throughout the podcast. It almost felt like his controller was off when you're playing FIFA on the goals. That was really kind of weird on that. So I will say it was definitely a roller coaster ride, a very exciting match. For me, it's unfortunately that the referee is such a big part of it, but I do think there are some good things that can come out of it, both for Inter and Juve. So now that we addressed that match, let's talk about the other one, Alex. So the day after that drama-filled match at San Siro, Napoli traveled to the Franchi Stadium to play Fiorentina. Koulibaly's early red card definitely had a big impact. Napoli didn't react the way Inter did after Vecino. So I wanted to ask you, how surprised were you by that result, especially after what happened at San Siro between Inter and Juve?
Yeah, considering how Juventus won against Inter, I'm not surprised at all. I pretty much saw it going like this, David. If Juve lost, I saw Napoli winning. If Juve drew, I saw Napoli drawing. If Juve won, I saw Napoli losing. And that's exactly how it went. Now, of course, it probably added to the fact that Napoli was watching the Inter-Juve match. They're thinking, oh my God, we're really going to be able to take the lead tomorrow. And then, of course, the Inter-Juve match ended how it ended. But how fitting is it? And I'm sure Napoli fans will say it's not fitting, just shut up, Alex. But how fitting is it that Koulibaly gets the goal the week before against Juventus, and then Koulibaly gets the red card in the 6th minute? I don't know if that's irony. I don't know if that's closure, David, but that's something. That has to be something. He obviously is Well, not obviously, but I think in my opinion, in your opinion, he is the most irreplaceable player on Napoli. Arguably the most, he's arguably the most important player. Just they're such an offensive team, so they really need Koulibaly on the pitch. And the big thing that was so glaring to me was how poor they are playing a man down. I mean, it's not easy to play a man down, but you just said it. Inter played pretty well a man down. Napoli was awful a man down. I know we're not huge into statistics, but this is a shocking statistic. Once the game was over, Fiorentina recorded 29 total shots, 10 of them on target. Napoli recorded 4 with 1 of them on target. That's 29-4 in terms of total shots. And the weirdest part about that is the possession was almost even. It was 51% to 49%. So that shows me that, yeah, they can possess the ball, but they really can't do anything a man down. As good as Sarri is when it's 11v11 and he knows what he's doing, I'm not completely sold. He's a great manager when the team is down a man. And really, Fiorentina is a good team. They played really well after Astori's death, and then they hit a little bit of a rut. But overall, you kind of had a feeling Fiorentina was going to come out with a really solid game at home, wanting to play well for Astori against the top team. I'm not surprised at all about how well Fiorentina played. But really, I mean, we've said it a couple times, Napoli's running out of gas, whether they're down a man or not. Lorenzo Insigne with a terrible performance. Dries Mertens, he's a shell of himself. Cahillon, a terrible performance. You've said it a couple times. Maybe Milik should have been starting by now for Mertens. Mertens has been incredible in Serie A, but he's really not playing well recently. And vice versa, whether Milik's in form or not, he's just a goal scorer. He can kind of get you a goal to get you going. So I don't know if now Sarri has been really too rigid or stubborn, or maybe he feels a little bit of the pressure of just the craziness of the way the table is swinging back and forth. But just what a crazy weekend. But no, to answer your question in a long-winded way, I'm not surprised considering Juve got the 3 points. How about you? Were you?
Yeah, no, my colleagues on Di Marzio's page can be my witnesses. Yesterday morning, I just sent them a message that I really thought Napoli was going to lose and lose badly. Because, look, you know, we've given them a lot of credit. They've come back up after some devastating blows, lost at home to Juve last December. The injuries to Goulam, Milik, they recovered from Juve getting back at the top of the standings. They won that huge game in Turin. But you mentioned it. I really think they ran out of gas. I think they went all out to win that match in Turin. And I think the way Juve came back to win against Inter must have been incredibly demoralizing. And I'm going to expand a little bit on what you said about Sarri. After the win in Turin, I said that Sarri went to Turin and won his way. We had suggested that maybe he rotate, try to surprise Juve, start Milik, Diarra, try to give a different look to the team. But he stuck to his guys, stuck to his way of playing, and it paid off. But the flip side is this week, he lost because of his way. As you mentioned, his players are really tired. Napoli, there's really no plan B with Napoli. There's Sarri ball, which is really great, really effective. I do think you can win with that when you're not against a juggernaut like Juve, but there's really no plan B. Koulibaly came out. He substituted Jorginho. So two of his most important players came out. Maybe he should have taken out an offensive player and just kind of go with Mertens and Insigne up front. So it's easy to second guess, but it's clear to me that Sarri is great, but he only has his way. So I thought, to me, he won his way in Turin. He won that huge match his way, but he might have lost the title because of his way. So there's more for him to learn. Granted, he's only been at the top level for a while, but I think in a way it was pretty emblematic as his limitations. As great as he is, we've praised him a ton, but there's definitely some room for improvement.
Now, sorry, I didn't mean to hurt your feelings. If you are listening, you are still more than welcome at Stamford Bridge managing my Chelsea. So I just needed to get that out there. All right, David, we always do this after a whole weekend of football. It is our winners and losers segment. So without further ado, who are our winners and losers of episode 108 of the Calcioland podcast?
So yeah, an exciting weekend in Serie A. 41 goals, a lot of implications in the Scudetto race, the Champions League race, certainly Juve getting a big step forward. Roma and Lazio look in better shape for the Champions League spot, but there's some other races that need to be decided, so we'll focus on those with our winners and losers. So Roma started the weekend, big win against Chievo. Our friend John Solano had pointed out that in the first time they played Chievo earlier in the season, they had struggled. That was not the case on this match. I'm going to have as winners and losers both Dzeko and Schick. For a while, it didn't seem that they could play together. Recently, that's been definitely better. I got to give credit to Schick. He looked like the bust of the year in Serie A. He's finishing the season quite well. We also had a good match for El Shaarawy. You know, he's the Padova connection. I'm always rooting for him. In the race to avoid relegation, two huge wins for Crotone and Spal. They now get out of the bottom three spots. They deserve a lot of credit. I want to give a huge shout out to Crotone coach Walter Zenga. I've never been a big believer in him as a coach. He was an amazing goalkeeper to me, very underrated as a player. I never was impressed with him as a manager, but I got to give him a lot of credit with what he's done with Crotone. Same with Spal. They've been a very feisty team. They went to Verona and beat Hellas Verona. So shout out to both of them. Then we had Milan play at Bologna. Good performances by Colonoglu, a player that's really shined a lot under Gattuso. I think he's definitely a player good enough to start for Milan next season. We also had a good match from Bonaventura, who needed to finish the season strong after struggling for the past month or so. Also want to give a shout-out to Sampdoria midfielder Pryett, who scored his first goal of the season. He's not really a goal scorer, but he's been very good this season. In addition to his first goal, he's also been linked to Roma, and I think he'd be a very intriguing player on Roma. Of course, they've done a lot of business with Sampdoria recently, as we saw with the Schick deal, so shout out to him. Next shout out to Cagliari striker Pavoletti, and this is a kind of a shout out to him because he has his 10th goal of the season. But someone that I really like following, Napoli Outsider on Twitter, pointed out that this was Pavoletti's 10th goal of the season, which means the three Italian strikers with the most goals for the season are, of course, Immobile, who's having a great season for Lazio but has struggled for Italy, and the next two are Inglese of Chievo, owned by Napoli, and Pavoletti. If that doesn't tell you how desperate the situation is for the Azzurri when it comes to the striker position, I don't know what does. Of course, you know, we have Belotti who might make a comeback. Maybe Balotelli will be in Serie A, but that's really grim. But in any event, good for Pavoletti getting to his 10th goal of the season. In the Juve match, you mentioned, Alex, how clutch Cuadrado has been. I mean, how many times has this guy saved Juve in a big match? And Higuain, on the other hand, the two clutchest goals of the season for Juve, you could say, were probably in the first leg at the San Paolo when he scored there, and then this one at San Siro. For someone not known for being clutch, he absolutely owned two huge moments. Next on Atalanta, a couple of players. This striker, Barrow, we've talked about, I think he's 19 years old. He's been playing recently. We've mentioned him a few times. He's really impressive, very good speed, maybe needs to improve his touch or whatnot, but it's interesting that Gasperini is trusting him so much with so much at stake because Atalanta's competing for a Europa League spot. We also want to give a shout out to Brian Cristante, the former Milan midfielder. He already has his 9th goal of the season with no penalties. He's been linked to all the top clubs in Italy. Then, of course, how could we not mention the Cholito Simeone, the hat trick in the Fiorentina match? Kind of a tribute to his dad, who had a crucial goal when he was playing for Lazio against Inter, which was a big factor in Juve winning the Scudetto in 2002. But a very strong performance by Simeone, not just the goals, but even how he was tracking back. And our final winner, you probably knew this was coming, Milinkovic-Savic. Previously, we'd mentioned how in the past month he has struggled, but he's finishing the season very, very strong, had the game winner against Torino yesterday. I'm sure Lazio's thrilled. He's helping him getting back to the Champions League and getting his transfer value sky high. So shout out to Milinkovic-Savic. The losers for the weekend, you know, I have to say, look, you know, I'm not a conspiracy theory guy at all, but I could see how, you know, if you're someone that denigrates Serie A because of the referee decisions or whatnot, like this was Christmas morning for you based on what happened. I'm never a fan of when the referee becomes the protagonist of a match. So Orsato is a loser for the weekend because of how it impacts Serie A as well. We mentioned Handanovic, a really puzzling on on those goals for someone that's usually so good. The flip side to Crotone and Spal, or Chievo and Cagliari, really, really struggling. Chievo decided to make a coaching change. Maran is gone. Cagliari almost sacked their manager, Lopez, but he's staying with them. Another loser, I was expecting more from Bologna and Donadoni. I think this season, I think Bologna is probably due to maybe start a new cycle with a new coach. Nothing against Donadoni, but he's been there for a while. And we mentioned the final loser, Napoli's lack of rotation, I think really came back to haunt them. So today, guys, because we have two interviews, we have Drake Cordero coming up, a fantastic interview, and we're going to close it out with 1,000 names. We didn't do the Twitter questions. We'll do a lot of them on Thursday. So as usual, please send them in. You can send in Serie A, reactions to Roma, Liverpool, transfer questions, TV, music, movies. You know, we love those. So just use the CalcioLand hashtag. This is my opportunity to thank you for all your support. Please keep leaving our ratings and reviews. If you're listening to us on iTunes, you can leave us a 5-star rating right now. We'll take you 2 seconds. You want to leave a comment, we really appreciate it and we'll read it. If you're listening to us on Android, you can listen to us on SoundCloud and Stitcher. Follow us there. So thank you so much for your support. And without further ado, the great Drake Cordero. I feel like I spent the entire weekend with our next guest because of the great coverage on BN Sport, all the Serie A matches. So I'm thrilled to be joined by our returning champion, Drake Cordero, one of the voices of Serie A here in North America, along with our friend Matteo Bonetti. So I'm excited to chat with Dre because there's a lot of juicy storylines in Serie A, but it also, I think, really fit into some of the other topics, more philosophical type of topics that Dre and I have discussed on the podcast. So we'll get that a little bit at the end, and first we'll go around the league. So Dre, always a pleasure to have you on CalcioLand. Welcome back on the show.
Thanks. You know, I love coming on. We've had some great chats. I don't know how many times I've been on so far, but you know, when you say that you feel like you spent the weekend with me, that means a lot, actually, because we do a ton of Serie A at BN Sports. And we have weekends like these, when you have that huge Juve game, when you have this huge Napoli game. I mean, last weekend seemed similar as well. It really is, at the risk of sounding really cheesy, it's an honor that people let us into their living rooms to experience those moments, because it's so much fun to do this, and to call it work is just, I feel embarrassingly lucky.
That's a great way of putting it. So let's talk about that great Inter-Juve match. I'm going to call it great because of all the excitement that was involved with it. There may be some people that would use another adjective for that, and we'll get that towards the end. So let me get your takeaway from that match in general, and I also want you to touch upon that last moment goal by Higuain. We've had so many roller coaster rides in Serie A the past few weeks, the point swings at the top of the standing 2 weeks ago, Koulibaly's goal in Turin, and now this Higuain goal. So let me get your takeaway on the match first, and then tell me where you rank that Higuain goal as far as shocking moments of the season.
Yeah, well, it was wildly entertaining. I mean, after Juve-Napoli, and maybe because of Juve-Napoli, the Inter-Juve match was the biggest game of the season. And I think both of those games, and all four teams, or all three teams, really lived up to the height, to the expectation. The Inter-Juve one was just absolute. I mean, more drama than Gomorrah. You had 5 goals, 2 of them own goals. You had VAR intervene 3 times in the first half, once to confirm the Douglas Costa goal, once to send Matias Vecino off. And then that late stoppage time, first half, Matuidi goal that was wiped off for offside. Yep. You got Juve down 2-1, 4 minutes left. They get 2 goals in 3 minutes to win it. And this is happening in the Derby d'Italia, no less, you know, with both teams playing for something really meaningful, because for Inter to make it back to the Champions League would be terrific. And that, you know, that was on the line for the Nerazzurri. Yeah. In terms of Koulibaly's goal and moments of the season versus Higuain's goal, you know, 2 weeks apart in 2 massive games, both late winners, both, you know, set piece headers, both hugely significant moments of the season. But just Higuain, by virtue of who he is always going to be the better story, the bigger story. He's such a polarizing figure. And the fact that, you know, he's an ex-Napoli player, that he leaves Napoli after that 36-goal season, that he meant this much to Juve, I think it's just a much bigger story than Koulibaly's 90th-minute winner.
I'm glad you mentioned the importance of Higuain to Juve. And I was just thinking about this last week because I remember when Juve signed Higuain. I mean, the storyline was like, look, Juve can win Serie A without him. We're going to have to really judge an acquisition because of the enormous cost of it, mainly on the Champions League. I mean, that has been the main storyline. But now I would say that without Higuain, I doubt Juve would win the Scudetto this season. A lot of Juve fans picked him as the best player on the team last season. I think you can make just as good a case for him now. So to me, his importance to Juve has really risen. So I wanted to ask you, the fact that he's so important to Juve's chances, odds of winning the Scudetto, does that say more about the rest of the league improving, so he has to be a difference maker there? Or is it that maybe this Juve isn't as strong as the ones in the past where they could be bailed out by other players, and now it's really more about Gonzalo?
Well, I think with Higuain, a lot of the initial reaction is going to be based on the price tag. And what we've learned, you know, time and time again, is that a player's price tag really only matters in the long term, you know, beyond the initial transfer window. It only really matters if a player flops. And Higuain hasn't really flopped. So the fact that he cost $90 million has sort of, you know, phased out of the conversation, and we don't really factor that in anymore. I do take a little bit of maybe the other side on the idea that they can't win it or couldn't win it without Gonzalo Higuain, because I think you have to factor in the opportunity cost of, you know, who would it be if not Gonzalo Higuain? And the only reason I say that is because we've seen Juve overcome the departures of, you know, elite coaches, elite players, and Tevez, Vidal, Pogba, Pirlo, Conte, and they can afford to go and sort of cannibalize direct Serie A rivals. They can snatch up an Higuain from Napoli, you know, buying high at that $90 million price tag. They can snatch up a Pjanic from Roma, or even a Bernardeschi, who really hasn't, you know, had a chance to really branch out or you know, show what he can bring to Juve just yet. Yeah, maybe he'll do that in season two, but they can take him away from a Fiorentina. And when they go shopping outside of Italy, they're not hitting up the outlet stores. They're not hitting up the seller leagues like in Eredivisie. They're going and getting Douglas Costa from Bayern. They're grabbing Blaise Matuidi from Paris, you know, winners, people who've won trophies, who can contribute, you know, right away. And it's not just Juve's level, or the level of the starting 11, but the depth that I think is the biggest difference. And yesterday, or this weekend, I think Saturday, the whole thing is a blur right now, by the way. You can see them bring off the bench a Dybala, a Bernardeschi, yeah, a Rodrigo Bentancourt, players who I think would be starting, you know, maybe Bentancourt, you can like him more or less, he still has a lot to prove, but players who would be starting for most, if not all, of the teams in Serie A. And those guys are coming off the bench in the biggest game of the season for Juve. Whereas compare that to a Napoli, who are bringing in Empoli players essentially off the bench. Zielinski, yeah, who I think is a good player, but Tonelli, who basically hasn't featured at all. Adik Milik, who because of injuries hasn't really had a chance to show his stuff. They bring those guys off the bench against Fiorentina in their biggest game of the season. I think that just that depth, the fact that they can go very deep in the bench, Juve, and still put out an incredible group. And they've shown versatility. Yeah. They've played in a variety of ways. That's what sets them apart from everybody else, Napoli, Roma, Inter, everyone.
So let's talk a little bit about Higuain's former team. So, you know, I got to give them a lot of credit. They came back a lot of times. I thought they were going to be down and out for the count. They came back many times. Maybe, though, this weekend was the final dagger. And as you pointed out, Higuain scoring such a huge goal that impacted his former team was kind of symbolic of this. So let's go on the assumption that Napoli doesn't make a comeback and they end up finishing second. How do you think this team will be remembered? Because there's a lot of people that would say, hey, you know, they probably should have tried harder, at least in the Europa League. They sacrificed or went all in for the Scudetto. But do you think, you know, we'll still remember this team fondly and their legacy will be, look, they just happened to lose to a great Juve that has dominated Serie A? Or do you think they'll be remembered as a team that should have done better, maybe in the January window, or maybe Sarri should have rotated less? So what do you think their legacy will ultimately be?
I think we'll remember them as a team who played really good football, but just weren't good enough to overcome an historically good Juventus, because obviously the main headline from this era will be, assuming that Napoli can't overturn this, that Juventus won an unprecedented 7 consecutive Scudetti, that they fended off challenges from, you know, Roma under Rudy Garcia, under Spalletti, they fended off Napoli under Maurizio Sarri. So yeah, I think Juve would be the main storyline, and that does mean that Napoli will be, if not completely forgotten, just sort of take a backseat to everything else. That trophies are really what's going to make the difference in the long term, once people forget about the way that they played. Because think, for example, of the, you know, Holland teams, the Clockwork Orange teams, you know, yeah. without that World Cup, yeah, sure, you're remembered, but you're not first and foremost in people's minds unless you actually achieve the success of winning the trophy at the end of the day. And so I'm going to remember Napoli for the style of play. We don't know if this is the end of the era just yet, whether Maurizio Sarri will leave in the summer, whether he'll stick around. If this is the end of the of an era, then I don't, while they may not be remembered as a great team, they certainly wouldn't be remembered as a champion by virtue of not being a champion. I think they maybe have overachieved in a lot of ways. If you believe Gazzetta's reporting, they're the fifth biggest payroll in Serie A. And they're the second best team in the league when you look at points, and arguably play the best football in Italy and one of the top playing sides in all of European football. So if you've got the fifth highest payroll, if you're forced to sell a player like Gonzalo Higuain to a direct rival, and you are still competitive, you're still playing at this high level, and you're a delight to the neutrals, I think that's success in my book. I mean, for me, Napoli has been must-see TV for the entire Maurizio Sarri era, and I think that's probably how I remember them, is for the style of play. They just won't be in the record books.
I agree with that. So, you know, Napoli is going to end up with their record points in the season. Roma did it twice during this Juve reign and had nothing to show for it. But at least Roma now has this great run in the Champions League. Of course, they eliminated Barcelona, won a group with Chelsea and Atletico Madrid. So let me ask you, do you see this Champions League run that Roma's in as a sign that teams other than Juve are improving in Serie A and that we might have multiple Serie A teams being factors in Europe? Or do you see this more as kind of a fluke and a one-off year for Roma?
Right. So I'm going to quote Homer Simpson here and say a little bit of column A, a little bit of column B. I think Roma have shown that they're a very good side. I don't know that, you know, zooming out big picture, that I see Roma as one of the top four teams in Europe at the moment, which is what you would, you know, what you would be suggesting by reaching the Champions League semifinals. I know that it doesn't work that way. I know that, you know, you have to, at this late stage of the campaign in the Champions League, get the bounce of the ball, you know, be relatively healthy, which is hugely important. So I don't think of Roma as a Champions League semifinalist. They're here now, obviously, and I think anyone who makes it to this stage can win it. But I would say Barcelona's play in the second leg had a lot to do with it. I'm not trying to take anything away from Roma. People will label me a Roma hater for this, and nothing could be further from the truth. I think it's reaching this stage, I think is the biggest value in it is it gives Eusebio Di Francesco some breathing room. I think there's a little bit of a murmur as to, you know, whether he's the right guy long-term for Roma, and maybe the football was unconvincing at times during the season. And so I think reaching the stage for Di Francesco in his first year with the Giallorossi, a guy who was part of the team the last time they won the Scudetto, is a big deal probably for his confidence, for his clout. I think Italian teams will definitely give everyone in Europe a run for their money when it comes to European football. I'm disappointed not to see more teams having this sort of success in recent years. I'm disappointed to see Napoli rotate when they play in the Champions League by virtue of not having, you know, a big enough, deep enough squad to compete on three fronts. But Roma's achievement, Roma knocking off Barcelona, who, if you watched Barcelona in the Copa del Rey final against Sevilla, that looked like a throwback Barcelona. That looked best team on the planet sort of good. And for Roma to have gotten past them in the way they did in that second leg, to play Barcelona off the park, to not let Barcelona play out of the back, which is such a staple of their style, speaks really highly of Roma, of their resolve, of their manager, of their culture. I'm really excited to see what happens under James Palota from here on out, because it really has been just a great sort of transition, and Roma's future looks relatively bright, whatever happens in the second leg.
Certainly Palota has had a big impact there, and I'm curious to see what he's going to do moving forward, the stadium, the fans and everything, but certainly off to a great start. So Dre, you've been this weekend, you called a bunch of Serie A games. I know that even when you're not calling a game on BN Sport, you're a big fan of the league. I know we can count on you to follow games constantly, like the rest of, like most of our listeners. So every time I'm on, I always like to ask you about some players that have stood out to you recently. So tell our listeners some players to watch in the tail end of the season, maybe in the summer transfer window and beyond. Which players have stood out to you recently?
Sure. Well, I mean, if you allow me, I'm going to completely ignore all of the top teams. Forget about the top four. Forget about the teams that everybody's watching. You all know that Paulo Dybala is a good player, and I don't have to tell you that. Awesome. One guy that we talked about before that I'll bring up again is Lucas Torreira, because he's continued to impress. So for Sampdoria, basically their terror in a teacup, 5 foot nothing, Lucas Torreira, a Uruguayan regista, holding midfielder, defensive midfielder, whatever you like, I think has been just terrific and probably has a really bright future at a big club. If not this summer, possibly can't be too much longer after that. But Lucas Torreira, I hope we get a chance to see some of him at the World Cup. I think he will make Oscar Washington Tabárez's squad for Uruguay, but he hasn't really been sort of featured even after getting called up. So I hope that that he'll get some minutes at the World Cup and we get to enjoy him, because he and Gaston Ramírez, who both should be playing with Uruguay at the Russia World Cup, will probably be on that squad, and both have been terrific for Sampdoria this season. I think Torreira is less of a well-kept secret now. I think people are finally starting to take notice. But I figured, you know, I'd start with him. This weekend, we did Fiorentina-Napoli, myself and Matteo Bonetti. And watching Federico Chiesa and Giovanni Simeone has been a lot of fun all season. You know, Fiore have had their ups and downs. These two players are basically like pro-evolution regens, right? You get the sons of two former Serie A players who are, you know, playing on the same team now at Fiorentina on a big stage like Artemio Franchi. And Chiesa is really exciting. Just watching him touch the ball is fun. There's always a sense that something's going to happen when he gets the ball out on the wing. And with Cholito Simeone, it's sort of the answer to what would have happened if Diego Simeone could have scored a lot of the goals. Because he seems to have the same sort of attitude and mentality, that hard work, workman-like mentality that Cholo Simeone had. Cholito is showing that, but as a center forward. And that is just a huge plus for any manager, to have a forward who's that willing to work off the ball, who's that willing to, you know, press the opposition to win the ball high up the pitch, even against a team like Napoli, who are usually very comfortable passing the ball out of the back, albeit in this case, Napoli were reduced to 10 men pretty early, right off the bat, with Koulibaly being sent off. So I would say keep an eye on both Chiesa and Simeone. And I would actually like to see both of those guys stick around for a season or two more. So we could see them play next to each other as much as possible. And two, so they're still very young. I'd like them to develop a little bit more before we pin all of the expectations of some, you know, huge transfer fee or whatever ends up happening in the future. And the last one, I'll go very obscure, right? So this is a guy who's only made 10 starts this season, but Udinese's Andrea Balic, same position as Lucas Torreira, although this weekend for Udinese, he was used in a more advanced role. I was blown away by the composure of this kid. When I watched him debut in Serie A as a teenager, he seems to invite pressure in midfield. He could be playing with his hands in his pocket and just delivering beautiful passes everywhere. He makes up his mind well before the ball arrives. It's a bit of a Sergio Busquets quality to him, respecting the difference between, you know, world champion Sergio Busquets and Andrea Balic. He's a player who I really enjoyed watching and who I hope to see a lot more of in the future.
Always interesting prospects in Serie A, and I like the ones you picked. Torreira's been certainly a favorite on the podcast. Before we get into tribalism with football, I'm going to ask you real fast, who would you like to see be the next coach of the Azzurri? There's been a lot of speculation on Ancelotti, Mancini, Ranieri. Who would be your pick and why?
So I don't have a very fun choice here, mostly because of, to me, what a national team coach is. I think at the national team level, you're much more of a squad selector. You're more about, you know, managing who gets into the squad and who gets the minutes than you are about imposing a particular style of play, just because you don't get that many training sessions with your team to really make dramatic changes beyond just who the personnel is. There are some exceptions, for example, like if you rely heavily on one team, on one club team, in the case of like the old Spanish team that won the World Cup and two European championships that was dependent heavily on Barcelona, who were used to playing a particular style, or Bayern Munich, who relied heavily, the German national team relied heavily on Bayern Munich and could sort of continue what those players do on a regular basis. I don't think you get that luxury necessarily as a national team coach. And so I think what you need is somebody who has the clout, who players will respect, or who can be, you know, who can be inspiring, or who can take pressure off the players. And so in that regard, I think Carlo Ancelotti would be fine. I think Roberto Mancini would be fine. I think those names that are being brought up are fine. Whoever it is going to have an insane amount of pressure, because it's absolutely ludicrous that the World Cup's going to take part without Italy. And so I don't envy whoever that next manager is.
So, I'm with you there. It's going to be definitely rebuilding a new cycle. So now let's talk about a topic near and dear to both of us. With the first time we had you on, there was a lot of buzz on our chat, like fan psychology and the way fans of different teams can look at the same exact match and interpret it in very different ways. So I want to expand on this and talk more about tribalism and how people, you know, who follow or in the same groups tend to think in a certain way. And I want to tie it into the episode on the red card for the Vecino and Mandzukic incident. For me, if you told me which team you support, and it doesn't necessarily have to even be Inter or Juve, depending on the team you support, I can a lot of times guess on what side of the aisle you're going to be right on almost any issue. So tell me your take on tribalism and how much that shaped the way people interpret it, even just that one moment between Vecino and Mandzukic.
Well, I think tribalism is sort of fundamental to our humanity. I think it's a basic human drive. I love talking about this stuff, by the way. So thanks for asking me about this.
Bring it on. We love hearing it.
To talk about psychology and philosophy and whatnot. But in this case, sports is just such a great place to study human psychology because yeah, it's sort of where we're allowed to commit all sorts of cognitive biases, to be just dead wrong for the sake of tribalism, you know, and everything seems sort of excessively tribal these days, but sports is the area that's sort of always been that and is unabashedly so. I mean, we wave our flags and colors in sports and we basically live and die with our teams and we claim to support our teams above anything, including reason. It's not surprising that fans would watch a game, the same game, the same 90 minutes, and interpret moments differently, because it's not the facts that we're disagreeing on. It's the interpretation of those facts that we have a disagreement on. The Vecino-Mandzukic one, I think in real time looked like a yellow would have been fine, at least to me. In real time, it looked quick. It looked like a yellow card would have been fine. With the benefit of VAR and taking a second and third and fourth look at it, it absolutely was a red card. I think objectively so. And then what ends up happening then is we attribute a lot of other stuff that has nothing to do with that particular moment to that decision. Yeah. So do Juve get the benefit of the doubt all the time? Well, that's sort of irrelevant to this particular moment, but we throw that into the bucket of this instance, even though it should be absolutely irrelevant. And so in terms of the tribalism, we form groups really, really easily, almost over almost anything. And then we develop our identity based on our allegiances to those groups, right? So if we form easy groups and then we tie our identity to those groups, when we defend the groups, when we defend our teams, when we defend our countries, when we defend our political parties, what we're really defending is our identity. And so we're no longer talking about the issue itself. We're no longer talking about the red card. We're no longer talking about gun control. We're talking about our own identity and the value that we place in belonging to a particular group. And often we don't have every single belief in common with everybody in our group, but it's sort of a simple way that we look at things. We don't have to think about it. It's sort of a cognitive shortcut where we don't have to think too much about it. We just sort of, okay, well, this is the side that we're on and we don't really have to evaluate that. We could move on. And the danger there is we tend to see other people as caricatures of themselves, the people who belong to other groups as sort of caricatures. And we attribute all sorts of things that don't necessarily apply to the individual to that individual because we apply those characteristics to their group, if that makes any sense.
It makes a lot of sense. And, you know, Dre, this is something that we chatted via text message a while back. You know, when you were going on about tribalism, it made me think about like the death of monoculture. And what I mean by that is, you know, I'm 41. When I was growing up, there wasn't that many TV stations. Almost everyone watched the same thing. When I wanted to follow calcio, you know, I read Gazzetta dello Sport. I read Guerino Sportivo, like the same publications. Everyone kind of had access to the same things. And now that's really changed. Now someone that wants to consume calcio, they can follow 60 different Milan accounts on Twitter that are giving them just information on Milan. If you want to watch a game in Italy, you can listen to the Milan announcer. You can kind of get like a home fan opinion take on the match. So to me, I think tribalism, which has always been in human nature, as you mentioned, to me, it's becoming much stronger because we no longer have this monoculture. We're all split into these little sects. So I wanted to get your take on that, if you think that's a factor in this as well.
Yeah, I think there's no question that social media in particular is amplifying tribal signaling. And what that means is, you know, a topic happens and, you know, instead of, again, dealing with the individual details of that topic, we sort of, as you mentioned, you can kind of delineate where people will fall on which side of that red card argument based on which of the two teams they support, as opposed to the sort of video replay itself. And so with tribal signaling, it's sort of like a call to action, and we're willing, this is, there've been countless social experiments since the 1970s that have shown we're willing to be wrong in order to stay in good standings with our group. We're willing to ignore new evidence. We're willing to sort of filter out the, you know, through confirmation bias, the stuff that we attribute to arguments and the stuff that we leave out based on what tribe we belong to and what will make us a good member of the tribe. And so we basically value being a good member of the group more so than we value accurate. So outside of like accuracy professions, like being a journalist or a scientist, I'm talking about in your day-to-day life, we think that we're these reasonable, rational creatures that do everything based on, you know, intense scrutiny of our own biases. In reality, we ignore most of that because what we're trying to do is we're trying to get in good standing with the group. And so we'll dress a certain way to belong to the group. We'll speak a certain way to belong to the group. And when you have social media giving everyone a voice, giving all of these different factions a voice, well, you really get to choose which one, where you go, what your filter bubble is. And as a result, yeah, you don't have that monoculture that you were talking about before, and you're going to become more and more polarized.
Well, Dre, this topic is so good. I have a feeling we're going to have to do a separate podcast just on this. You're really a gem. So this was your fourth time on. I love having you on. Always such great insight. So thank you so much for joining us. Best of luck with the end of the season on Serie A and BN Sport. Keep up the great work.
I appreciate it, David. Thank you.
There you have it. That was our returning champion, Dre Cordero, one of our very favorite guests who always kills it on the podcast. So to end it today, we wanted to do something a little bit different. You guys have been listening and following along to Thousand Names picks throughout the season. I've known Thousand for quite some time. I knew once we were going to start doing game picks on the podcast that he was going to be the guy for this. Been following him on Twitter for quite some time. At first, you know, definitely he likes to joke around. At first, I thought his predictions were absolutely crazy, but then I've really gotten to see the art to what he does. So we wanted to thank him for all his picks this year by giving him a section on the podcast. So today, I interviewed him on the main storylines in Serie A, getting his predictions. So we recorded his answers in Italian. I translated them to English. So for those of you that speak Italian, I think you'll really, really enjoy it. For those of you that don't and are studying it, you can pick up some words here or there. But I think you'll really enjoy his answers. So thank you, Thousand Names, for all you do on the podcast. It was great to have you on. So we have a very special guest today. You guys have heard his fantastic picks throughout the year, but with so many big storylines coming up in Serie A and in the Champions League, we wanted to get him actually on the podcast to get his take on how the season's going to end. So the way we're going to do it, I'm going to ask the questions in English to our oracle, Thousand Names. He'll respond in Italian. I know many of you listening are fluent in Italian. And then I'll translate the answer back for those of you that speak English. We're going to cover the main topics remaining in the season. So Thousand Names, you've been one of the big stars of the podcast. Benvenuto a Calcioland. È un piacere averti sul programma.
Il piacere è tutto mio, sono il vostro più grande ascoltatore.
Ottimo, ok. Allora, let's start with the big match that we saw on Saturday. You've been tweeting a lot about this. You are an expert on both Inter and Juve. You had some fantastic tweets about it over the weekend before the match and during the match. So you've lived through a lot of great matches between Inter and Juve. So tell our listeners how you think this match is going to be remembered by history. There's been a lot of them, but this one was certainly very controversial.
In realtà credo che nonostante fosse una partita importante, perché la Juve si giocava lo scudetto e l'Inter l'accesso alla Champions League, poi il valore delle due squadre resta comunque differente, quindi non si può paragonare alla sfida, ad esempio, del 98, con il famoso caso Juliano Ronaldo, o quella di inizio anni 2000, quando le squadre, bene o male, erano di livello simile, quindi magari ti giocavano proprio lo scudetto. Tuttavia è stata una partita che aveva un certo valore ed è stata anche poi spettacolare, anche per le varie decisioni arbitrali. Comunque, non essendo uno specialista della Moviola, preferisco non commentare, detto che ovviamente ci sono delle decisioni che fanno e faranno discutere, probabilmente faranno giurisprudenza.
E dimmi, c'è una Juve che hai detto che è abbastanza paragonabile a quella che abbiamo visto dell'Inter di oggi? Avevi un buon paragone rispetto al 2010? Raccontami di quello.
In realtà, come anche se in maniera opposta, questa sfida mi ha ricordato quella del 2010 dell'Inter del triplete, che faticò molto ad avere la meglio sulla Juve di Zaccheroni. Era una Juve quella che lottava per il settimo posto, che veniva da una serie di partite negative, tuttavia complice l'atmosfera, il fatto che di fronte avesse una grande squadra, giocò alla morte, pur trovandosi in 10 uomini, diciamo, da inizio partita, e costrinse l'Inter a tirare il meglio, infatti la partita del gran gol di Maicon da 30 metri. E credo che, a parte invertite, questa sfida possa essere paragonata a quella.
So, great answer here. So, to tell you what Fauzan shared with us. So, obviously, there was a lot of drama because of the referee decisions and how important a match this was for Juve, for the Scudetto, and Inter for the Champions League. But Fauzan pointed out that unlike the classic matches like 98, the match between Giuliano and Ronaldo that everyone remembers, or even in the early 2000s, the two teams are really pretty different right now. Juve is obviously a serious contender across Europe. Inter's trying to get back to the Champions League. So there is a difference between those earlier competitions when both teams were great. And I asked Fauzan to compare this to another more recent Inter-Juve, and he pointed out, in a way, this is similar back in 2010 when Inter won the treble. This was one of the worst Juves ever. They had Zaccheroni managing the team at the end of the season. Juve played them really, really tough, almost made a heroic win, but ultimately they lost to a better team with a great goals by Maicon and Neto. So really good comparison there, but no doubt this match is going to be remembered for all the drama around it. So Fauzan, next question, and I know Immobile right now there is potential for an injury, so we're not sure, but we have a great race for the Capocannoniere in Italy. So if you had to pick for our listeners, who do you think is going to finish the season at the top of the Capocannoniere race between Icardi and Immobile?
Ma credo che bisogna aspettare l'esito degli esami perché, come abbiamo visto ieri, Ciro Immobile ha avuto un infortunio muscolare durante la partita Torino-Lazio e chiaramente questo può condizionare la corsa per il capocannoniere. Tuttavia io credo che l'attaccante napoletano sia favorito su Mauro Icardi, anche perché la Lazio è una squadra che tende a segnare di più rispetto all'Inter, che pratica un gioco più sparagnino.
So, as Fauzan pointed out, we're waiting for the result on Immobile's recent injury. It sounds like it's a muscular injury. He still thinks he's the pick. Obviously, another Napoletano doc like our friend Fauzan names, although Icardi's in great form, he still gives an edge to Immobile. Now, let's talk about the big game tomorrow, Fauzan. We saw Roma make an unbelievable comeback against Barcelona, and now they are trying to do it again against Liverpool. Now, math-wise, it's about the same. They need 3 goals, like against Barcelona. But I want to ask you, do you think Roma has a chance to make a comeback, and how do you rate their chances?
Non darei più di un 10% alla Roma di ribaltare, tipo, come possibilità di ribaltare il risultato, perché fondamentalmente la Roma quest'anno ha disputato 2 grandissime partite all'Olimpico, 3-0 contro Chelsea e contro Barcellona. Tuttavia il Liverpool è una squadra diversa dalle due compagini inglesi e spagnole, è una squadra che gioca a ritmi altissimi e che ben si sposa con il centrocampo lento della Roma. Nainggolan, Strootman, De Rossi sono giocatori lenti che fanno fatica contro i ritmi altissimi della squadra di Klopp. E anzi, se proprio dovesse entrare nello specifico, io credo che il Liverpool possa pareggiare o addirittura vincere anche domani, perché davvero l'andata è stata difficile per la Roma, a differenza di quando è successo al Camp Nou, dove sebbene avesse perso 4-1, poi in realtà si era giocata anche abbastanza bene la partita.
So Fausen points out that although Roma had some great matches at the Olimpico and the Champions League, we saw them against Chelsea and Barcelona, he sees this as pretty differently because of Liverpool's great pace and the way they play. He points out how Roma's midfield is pretty slow and it's going to be hard to hold up to the rhythm of the English team. So if he were to predict this match, he wouldn't give more than a 10% chance to Roma to make another comeback. And if he really had to make a pick for our podcast, he would say either a draw or a win by the Reds. And I tend to agree with that. So Fausen, another, I think, you know, as we're talking today, the Scudetto race, even the Champions League spots, I feel like that's pretty decided. So I'd put you on the spot, but I think I know what you're going to pick. But the race to avoid the relegation, la corsa per la retrocessione, la salvezza della retrocessione is really exciting this season. We saw Crotone and Spal make a really big comeback over the weekend. So if you had to guess which team's going to go down to Serie B along with Benevento and Hellas Verona.
Io credo che sebbene la corsa sia aperta, oltre al Chio, alla Spal, al Crotone, all'Udinese, al Cagliari, io vedo i Crivenzi favoriti per la retrocessione, perché mi sembra una squadra che abbia già intrapreso la discesa e non vince da molto tempo, e non vedo nemmeno nei giocatori quella voglia di lottare per la salvezza che sta contraddistinguendo il cammino di Spalla e Crotone. Basti pensare a come ha perso il Chievo la partita col Napoli, era avanti 1-0, ha preso due gol su calcio d'angolo. E, tuttavia la squadra di Verona resta un esempio positivo del calcio italiano, e sono convinto che già l'anno prossimo la società farà di tutto per risalire in Serie A, perché a Verona sanno fare un buon calcio all'italiano.
Mm-hmm. So Fausen believes that Chievo is the most likely team to be relegated along with Benevento and Verona. As he pointed out, unlike Spal and Crotone, who have been fighting back, Chievo almost seems resigned to their fate. He points out to a team that was really motivated to try to avoid relegation would have probably put up a better fight against Napoli once they had the lead. He also points out that the club may already be making plans as if they're going to be relegated to come back to Serie A pretty quickly. They waited a while to get rid of manager Maran, and they replaced him with the manager from their Primavera team, from their youth team. So it's almost like they want to start fresh and start planning for next season already. But he does point out that Chievo really is a reality, and in general in Verona, the teams really do take calcio seriously. They are a good example of the good things about Italian football, and I agree with them. Verona has always an incredible amount of fan support, and Chievo, which is a tiny fraction of the city, has been in Serie A for quite some time, but their luck might run out this season. So, Fausen, let's end with the other big question. You are our oracle. When we need a prediction, we come to you. There's been a lot of speculation on who will be Italy's next manager. Ventura's gone. Doesn't look like Di Biagio will get the job permanently. So who do you think is going to get the Italy job, and what would you do if you were running the federation?
La stampa italiana sta spingendo sia Carlo Ancelotti che Roberto Mancini come nuovo allenatore della nazionale italiana. Tuttavia, in questo momento, io, se dovessi fare un nome, direi Massimiliano Allegri. Il suo ciclo alla Juve si concluderà praticamente tra qualche settimana con la conquista del 7º scudetto e il suo 4º consecutivo, e non credo che la sua permanenza, non credo che resterà ancora anche l'anno prossimo. Insomma, la squadra sta dando segni di cedimento, e con un Allegri, se Allegri non dovesse trovare un team europeo disposto a prenderlo, perché non provare a dargli la nazionale? In fondo lui è un grandissimo selezionatore, a differenza di altri tipi di allenatore che sono più uomini di campo, più da lavoro settimanale. Lui è uno che il suo meglio lo dà nello scegliere i giocatori e nel metterli in campo, quindi dico Massimiliano Allegri.
Wow, bold pick. So Fausen points out that while the Italian media has been pushing for Mancini and Ancelotti as the main candidates, and that's really who you read most of the time, If Thousand was running the Federation, what he'd do is he'd at least make a phone call to Max Allegri, because his cycle at Juve looks to be coming to an end. They're about to win their fourth Scudetto in a row with him on the bench, seventh. But the team looks like they're really ready for a new cycle. He considers Allegri, this job would be perfect for Allegri, because not only is he a really good tactician, he's a very good selector of a player. So he feels like his strength would be the tactics, setting up the team to succeed, as opposed to being on a daily basis with the players in training. So very, very interesting. So listen, Thousand, I can't thank you enough. Everyone loves your predictions on the podcast. We look forward to wrapping up the season with you. It was a pleasure to finally have you on. E grazie mille che ci hai raggiunto oggi. Continua l'ottimo lavoro coi pronostici.
Grazie a voi per avermi ospitato e spero sempre di essere all'altezza della fama che ho.